From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we've reached another grim milestone in the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases, which reached 2 million here in the U.S., with at least 113,000 deaths. And cases are spiking in more than 20 states, including Arizona, Texas, and South Carolina.
And the economic impact continues. Another 1.5 million people filed unemployment claims last week. Let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Anya.
So this is the 12th week in a row that we've seen an increase in unemployment. What does the latest number show?
Well, so it shows that we've actually reached a number of 44.1 million people who have made initial claims in the past 12 weeks. Now, there are a couple of issues here. One is that a number of states have told workers to reapply if they were first found ineligible. So there may actually be some duplicate applications in here. The good news is that the weekly tally of people filing for unemployment has fallen for 10 weeks straight. But the bad news is the first number was 6.9 million at the end of March. So, you know, hopefully by July, we've got fewer than a million each week, but we're still in the wrong direction. That's the thing to remember. The weekly tallies in the recession of October 1982, that was 695,000. So we are still in staggeringly high numbers of people who are filing for unemployment.
There's something else. So the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported that the economy added jobs in May, first reporting that the unemployment rate fell to about 13%. Then it corrected itself and said it's closer to 16%. That's still lower than it was in April, but higher than it was during the Great Depression. I know this is not an apples to apples comparison, but is there any indication the unemployment rate will shrink as states reopen their economies?
Well, we're hoping that that's the case. Part of the problem is that a number of states that have reopened have now seen increases in hospitalizations due to COVID-19. So now folks are worried about, and we're seeing that in the stock market today, concerns about a second wave. But yeah, part of this shows what a weird situation we're in that the unemployment number, the rate, is determined by phone calls. It's a survey. And the people who were doing the survey mischaracterized what people were. If you're furloughed, are you unemployed or are you, you know, temporarily out of work? And that's why the miscalculation. So the estimates are we're still in double-digit unemployment probably for most of 2020. The Federal Reserve suggests that it could be lower than that by next year.
Fed Chair Jerome Powell said the Fed is not thinking of raising interest rates. What is he watching for that would signal a turnaround in the economy?
Well, so the Fed watches two things in particular. They watch inflation, which is when the economy gets too hot and the cost of things increase. There's no danger of that right now, obviously, because we're in a recession. The other thing it watches is unemployment. So as long as unemployment is increasing or not below a level that the Fed thinks is appropriate, which is really below 5%, there will not be any interest rate increases. And because interest rates are so low and because the Fed has offered to buy up loans, you know, mortgages from banks and business loans, that's actually why you're seeing a strong stock market performance generally in the last several weeks, because interest rates are really low. There's nowhere else for your money. And the Federal Reserve is guaranteeing loans. But there is, I think, zero chance of Federal Reserve rate increases probably for the next 2 years, let alone the next year.
You know, Ali, even if the economy recovers, there will still be a lot of lasting damage. What kind of impact will this fallout from the coronavirus have on things like retirement savings?
Yeah, well, this is actually going to hit retirement savings harder than the Great Recession did. 18% of Americans said retirement plans were severely affected by the Great Recession in 2007 to 2009. 43% of Americans say they're still recovering financially from the Great Recession. So here's the thing. Stock markets are almost back to where they were at the beginning of the year. But for a lot of people, depending on where they are in their life, they might have cashed out of those or they're not invested in the kinds of things that have been bouncing back, or they became more conservative about it. So it sometimes takes quite a while to recover from the stock market effect of it. But remember, that's just one effect of it. Your job is, generally speaking, the greatest wealth creator in your life. Stock market is recovering, but jobs are going to be a while before they do.
I want to ask you something else before we let you go. You were shot with a rubber bullet when you were covering the protests in Minneapolis. What happened and how are you?
Thank you. I'm fine, although I'm more stunned than anything else on two levels. One is, in the work we do, sometimes you're going to get tear gassed and shot by rubber bullets. I never thought that would happen in America. So mm-hmm. I now, when I cover these things, like a lot of other reporters, have a hardened helmet, a gas mask. The bigger issue is the degree to which, according to the Columbia Journalism Review, 300 reporters had interactions with police that were negative or, intimidation by police. So there's a bit of a First Amendment issue going on here about the freedom of the press to cover these protests. Probably about half a dozen of my colleagues were also in some fashion hit by either tear gas canisters or marking rounds mm-hmm. or rubber bullets. So it's been a very, very interesting few weeks in terms of covering these protests.
Well, I'm glad you're okay for sure.
Thank you.
Ali Velshi with MSNBC. He's an anchor and economics correspondent, as always. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks.
Well, the top U.S. general, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, issued a pretty stunning apology today. In a videotaped commencement address to the National Defense University, Milley said he was wrong to appear in photographs with President Trump when the president walked to that boarded-up church near the White House last Monday, after Trump called in the National Guard and police forcibly cleared the area of peaceful protesters.
I should not have been there. My presence in that moment and in that environment created a perception of the military involved in domestic politics. As a commissioned, uniformed officer, it was a mistake that I have learned from, and I sincerely hope we all can learn from it.
With us now is NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie. And Greg, we had been expecting the president might comment on this as he took off in his helicopter today, but in a rare move, he said nothing at all. Of course, we don't know at all if that's connected. But how extraordinary is what Milley did say?
Well, it was very unusual to make this very direct apology in a pre-recorded message. But we should also note it was very calibrated. He didn't criticize President Trump or any of the actions that were taken when the demonstrators were removed. But that does show this real soul-searching that's going on at the top levels of the Pentagon when it comes to questions of politicization and using the military for domestic political issues. And this also comes a week after the Defense Secretary, Mark Esper, held a press conference saying that he didn't want to deploy troops against protesters. And we know that angered the president.
Yeah. And well, this comes also after a torrent of criticism from other generals over the past week. James Mattis and John Kelly, who both served in the Trump administration, Colin Powell. Now, Republicans can write some of them off as having been rejected by Trump, but how much pressure do they put on Milley?
Well, I think it certainly did. I mean, he heard this wave of criticism from these former defense secretaries and four-star generals. And these are the top military people that he's been working with literally for decades. He accepted full responsibility for his presence there, and he noted that it did spark this debate about the military and civil society. The venue is also significant as well. His video was shown at a graduation ceremony for the National Defense University. These are up-and-coming officers, and he said as senior leaders, as many of these people are likely to become, everything you will do will be closely watched.
Yeah, well, you mentioned Mark Esper last week. Pentagon Secretary Mark Esper apologized for using the term battle space in reference to where protesters were. It was thought he'd be fired. What about Milley? What's his relationship with the president?
Well, his relationship has been pretty good. It was sort of announced at the Army-Navy football game in sort of an untraditional way by the president last year. He's been seen as having a pretty good relationship. Trump has certainly liked him, his sort of brusque manner and his no-nonsense approach. But we do know on the day of this photo op, there were heated discussions going on for a good chunk of that day in the Oval Office involving Milley and Defense Secretary Esper arguing very strongly against using troops against protesters. And so after that long argument, they then walked outside, and this is where the controversy began.
Well, this also comes a day after President Trump rejected calls to rename military bases that have been named after Confederate generals. And despite moves by the Marines and the Navy to renounce Confederate symbols, and then there's, the questions of the use of the military. Is there a split with the president?
Well, I'm not sure I'd use that term, but you have seen certain friction here. And I wouldn't say it's just necessarily between the military. You've seen a number of Senate Republicans come out, and they've also talked about considering legislation for changing these names of Southern military bases named after Confederate generals. They've talked about the need not to use the military against protesters. So it isn't just really the president versus the military here. I think there's been we've seen a split that hasn't gone along clean lines. You've had Republicans, Democrats, people, leadership in the military.
Well, today the Republican-led Senate Armed Services Committee agreed to set up a commission to rename those bases. So there may be a showdown on the horizon. Greg Myrie, national security correspondent for NPR. Greg, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Robin.
We're in a pandemic, a race moment, problems with the economy, but this is also a China moment. The virus likely started there, and think of the trade and tariff wars. So we want to take a step back to look at a fascinating new book about China's evolution and the important role played by Jews. Yes, two Jewish families whose massive business empires and work rescuing refugees in World War II helped shape the country we see today, especially Shanghai. Jonathan Kaufman is author of The Last Kings of Shanghai, the rival Jewish dynasties that helped create modern China. He's also director of the Journalism School at Northeastern University. Jonathan, welcome.
Thanks very much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, and this is nothing less than, you know, the history of China over the last several hundred years. So we're going to have to hopscotch through. It reads at times like an epic or a masterpiece theater. We have these two families, the Sassoons, the Kadouris. The Sassoons come to China first from Baghdad. David Sassoon, the patriarch, fleeing mistreatment in the early 1800s with just a shirt on his back. And with eight sons, he builds this billion-dollar dynasty that, as you write, would bankroll a king and advise prime ministers and educate others through a school system. Eli Kadouri was a student. He'd then go build his own family dynasty, becoming one of the richest men in Asia. The Kadouris, the Sassoons. How did this happen? Like, what was the pull of it? Wasn't really China, it was Shanghai. What was the pull?
Well, I think what we tend to forget sometimes is that some empires are built on military or on missionaries. This was really built on business. When the British opened up China during the Opium Wars in the 1840s, their goal was to make China a place where people could make money. And the Sassoons were at that point in India. David Sassoon was dabbling in the opium trade, and he saw this great opportunity. And so he had eight sons and began to deploy his sons across China to see if he could open up markets. And Shanghai became the place where, if you were young and ambitious, it was the place to go.
And there's a little bit of a whiff of colonialism here. I mean, you say opium, it's kind of like the Kennedy family, you know, made their money on trade of alcohol. This was something that not everybody approved of. I mean, there were people who were saying this opium is not helping our injured Chinese workers. It's making them addicts. I mean, there was some controversy over the way they made their money.
There was, and I think the analogy is probably close to the cigarette and alcohol industry, as you say, with the Kennedys, which is opium was legal at this time. There's no question that the Chinese were opposed to it. But one of the geniuses, the business geniuses of the Sassoons, was that they found a way to exploit the sale of opium in a way that managed to both monopolize the production of it in India. They then shipped it to China and then worked with Chinese middlemen to then sell it in Chinese shops. Mm-hmm. And I think in the end, the moral concerns were something that they didn't think about very much.
They also built huge hotels, whole school systems, dabbled in rubber, electricity. You've described their businesses, even with criticism of the opium trade, you've described their businesses as enlightened. How so?
Well, I think, you know, Shanghai before the Sassoons and the Kadouris arrived was a big city, but it was really a backwater. And what the Kadouris and the Sassoons did with their hotels and their other investments was really put Shanghai on the map. And they gave it, by the 1890s, Shanghai had a very advanced transportation system, a gas system, electricity. It had those incredible buildings that we see now along the waterfront, along the Bund, It had as many skyscrapers as cities like Chicago. You had thousands of people coming on cruise ships to stay at these hotels and experience China, Charlie Chaplin, mm-hmm. Noel Coward. It was a place suddenly that everyone wanted to visit. It was the Paris of the East, and the Sassoons and the Kadouris were very much part of creating that atmosphere.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much here. And we're just a few decades after Apenela's father arrived when we've got this magnificent dynasty. But we must fast forward because it's time to land in the 1930s. And here we are in an old noir black and white movie. Victor Sassoon, descendant of David, the looks of a film actor, maybe the lifestyle too. And thousands of Jews are fleeing Europe ahead of World War II and the Nazis. And the senior, Elie Kadouri, of the other family, in an encounter between these rival empires, tells Victor, stop being a playboy and help form a united front on refugees. And they do. Just briefly, what do they do to bring Jews from Europe?
Well, the Jews are fleeing Europe because there's no other place they can go. Every other city, every other country has shut the doors. But Shanghai, because it's occupied by the British, by the Americans, by the Japanese, is an open city. But the important thing is the Japanese are tightening a noose around Shanghai. They've invaded China, and the Japanese are allied with the Nazis. And Victor Sassoon essentially produces one of the great con jobs in world history, where he basically helps convince the Japanese that he is so influential and that Jews are so influential that they can help keep the Japanese from going to war with the United States and with Great Britain. The Japanese are somewhat anti-Semitic already. They're very suspicious of Jews. They believe Jews do control the world. And Victor Sassoon decides he's not going to disabuse them of that notion, but instead will sort of string them along by inviting them to his nightclubs, to his parties, all the time saying, let these Jews stay and I'll try to work on things behind the scenes. In truth, behind the scenes, he was spying on the Japanese. He was, some believe, working for British intelligence. He was buying up land in South America, believing that perhaps he could resettle Jewish refugees there, until finally the Japanese caught on and Victor had to flee the country just before Pearl Harbor.
In fact, they had been living in this secluded, you know, marble-floored, gilded area within Shanghai, but that, as you say, the noose is tightening. And along the way, though, the families have interactions with Chiang Kai-shek, the anti-communist nationalist leader, Mao Zedong, the communist counter-revolutionary, Sun Yat-sen, as you write, China's George Washington, who overthrew the empire. I mean, it's just so remarkable. But the gilded cage gets dismantled. What happened?
I think in the end, the Kadouris and the Sassoons were brilliant businessmen, but politically, they missed the rise of communism. I mean, you speak to their children and grandchildren today, they acknowledge that. They put all their bets on the nationalists, and the Kadouris were much the same way. So they, after World War II, when the Americans liberate Shanghai, the Sassoons and the Kadouris come back thinking they can resume life as normal. But of course, they can't. And they end up losing everything in Shanghai. The Sassoons leave and they never go back. The Kadouris go to Hong Kong and decide that they're going to try to do it differently. And they recognize that they were part of what led to the rise of communism, the inequality, the great wealth amidst great poverty. But at the same time, they also feel they should do more for the Chinese. And so one of the things the Kadouris do is they rebuild their fortune in Hong Kong, is they end up helping 300,000 Chinese refugees, helping them start small farms, small plots where they can make a living. And they try to correct some of the mistakes they saw that the earlier generations had made. And it pays off for them. They become incredibly wealthy and then return to China in the 1970s and 80s, richer than ever.
Hmm. You have one scene where I think it's a grandson, Michael, comes back after China slowly opens after 1979 and slowly opens, still a communist country. But he goes back years later and finds the family servant who helped raise him. And there's this, you know, emotional tears are spilled. But you stumbled on this when you were a young foreign correspondent in the late 70s. You say the country was drab after 30 years of communist totalitarianism. But then you suddenly land in a former Sassoon hotel and you see marble stairways and chandeliers, and what was this? And there beneath the grime, you start to find this story of this opulence. What do you think they meant, if anything, to modern China today, to China's opening, to China's sense of business. Is there a connection?
I think often when we tell history, we're focusing on the politicians, on the generals, but we don't really talk as much about the role of business and companies and businessmen. And this story is a family saga, but it's also a story of how important business was in the development of China. I think the other part of it is that the Chinese really suppressed this history for decades. They didn't want to talk about it. Their narrative was that China was conquered by foreigners, and then the communists came along, kicked the foreigners out, and then the communists led China into the 21st century. But in some ways, this became, for me, almost an alternate history of China. This was a China that was much more cosmopolitan, much more globalized. And you can see that today. Anybody who goes to China or reads about it sees how Shanghai is such a different city than Beijing or than any other city in China. And that's because of these families. I think part of what's going on now is that China is turning inward again. It's turning nationalist again. And when you talk to people in Shanghai, they're uncomfortable with that. And when you talk to many Chinese, they talk with affection about these families because they brought such a beautiful lifestyle to the city in some ways, while recognizing there was also incredible inequality. And I think the choice for China now is, will they continue to go that route of being open to the West, of welcoming people all over the world the way Shanghai always did, or will it become more insular, more inward-looking, more repressive? And I think Shanghai represents a different future, the same way it represented a different past.
Jonathan Kaufman, author of The Last Kings of Shanghai, The Rival Jewish Dynasties That Helped Create Modern China. Jonathan, I smell movie.
Well, there's certainly been a lot of interest. And I think these days when we're all at home and looking for good books to read and good things to watch on television, why not?
And you could start on the screenplay. Jonathan, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Protests over racial injustice are spreading across the country while a pandemic continues to take its toll. The next weeks and months are leading to a consequential election this November. And every day, the NPR Politics podcast is here to discuss how it could reshape your world.
Legislators throughout the country are scrambling to balance budgets before July 1st, the new fiscal year. In California, Democratic lawmakers want Governor Gavin Newsom to include programs aimed at helping the working poor. From KQED in San Francisco, Scott Schaefer reports on one such program that's not available to many immigrant families, at least not yet.
5 years ago, California created its own version of a federal program called the Earned Income Tax Credit, or EITC. It gives low-income people who file federal income taxes a cash refund. Supporters like Sasha Feldstein with the California Immigrant Policy Center say the program rewards work.
Because the more that you earn, the more you can get through the credit. So that's a reason why conservatives and Republicans tend to like the EITCs.
But there's a catch. If one or more family members aren't eligible to receive a Social Security number, the entire family is ineligible.
Mi hija es nacida en México.
That's Rosalba, a 41-year-old immigrant who came to California from Mexico 18 years ago with her 3-month-old daughter. Because she and her husband, Javier, came to the U.S. illegally, we're just using her first name. Like so many families these days, Rosalba and Javier are working far fewer hours in their restaurant jobs in San Diego due to the pandemic. And she says she could really use the $1,600 her family could get from the California EITC if they were eligible.
The earned income tax would make a huge difference for my family, especially under the conditions right now.
Rosalba and her husband have been paying taxes for 17 years. They have 3 kids born here, but her family isn't eligible for the Cal EITC. Alyssa Anderson with the California Budget and Policy Center says that's unfair, especially given that the state currently offers about $60 billion in tax breaks each year, most of it going to corporations and wealthier residents.
The same tax system that excludes immigrants, who are overwhelmingly people of color, provides enormous benefits to mostly white Californians. And so that just perpetuates racial inequalities.
In fact, undocumented immigrants are ineligible for a wide range of safety net programs like Social Security. When Governor Gavin Newsom announced a program to give them one-time cash payments during the pandemic recently, he noted how little undocumented immigrants get back for the taxes they pay.
Paying just last year over $2.5 billion of local and state taxes. Yet many in mixed status families are having a hard time taking care of their children.
While Newsom supports the Cal EITC in general, he's yet to embrace extending it to undocumented tax filers. Democratic Assemblywoman Eloise Reyes from San Bernardino is sponsoring a bill to change that.
These immigrants are going to continue to live here. Many of them have U.S.-born children. And more importantly, they're working and they are filing their taxes here.
In its state budget, the legislature proposes expanding the tax credit to undocumented families with children who are younger than six. That still leaves many people ineligible. During final negotiations this week, it'll become clear if Governor Newsom accepts that compromise, with the state facing a $54 billion deficit. For Here and Now, I'm Scott Schaefer.
This week, President Trump tweeted the false claim that the elderly protester shoved by police in Buffalo was a member of the anti-fascist group Antifa. He is not. Last Sunday, the president once again said he would designate Antifa a terrorist organization. He said the same thing last year after followers rumbled with the far-right group the Proud Boys. But Antifa has never been accused of killing anyone, unlike the KKK, which is not declared a terrorist organization. Attorney General Barr says Antifa was responsible for the looting and violence we saw early on in riots that followed protests, but federal court records show no sign of Antifa links. NPR has reviewed court documents of 51 people facing charges. So far, none is alleged to have links. And local arrest records show most of those involved were locals, angry residents, and disaffected kids. And many peace activists on the left have disavowed Antifa's anti-fascist tactics, saying to attack violence with violence defeats the purpose. So everyone is talking about Antifa. Let's get a reminder of who they are with Brandi Zarazny, an investigative reporter for NBC News, who's taken a deep dive. Hi, Brandi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. So who or what is Antifa?
Well, Antifa is sort of a loose organization. It has its roots back in the 20s and 30s with groups in Germany and the UK who fought against those rising fascist movements. And the modern Antifa movement began in the 60s and came to the US in the 70s and the 80s with groups that would fight skinheads at punk rock shows. They have a sort of ideology that says that fascism and people they believe to be fascists are violent in nature inherently. The movement is violent. And so they feel that violence to counteract that is allowed and is useful. The idea is that if more people had, you know, brawled in the streets with actual Nazis, then Hitler and the Nazi Party would have never risen to power. So Antifa has popped up again now with the election of Donald Trump, the rise of the alt-right, and the rise of far-right extremists and white nationalist groups that have sort of come up all at the same time.
Yeah. And so to be clear, what you just said, there's no leader, there's no organization. This is what critics say about President Trump's claim that he will make them domestic terrorists. First of all, we don't have a domestic terrorism law, but there's no leader or organization to charge. And we do know that there is one maybe more organized cell called Rose City Antifa in Portland, Oregon. They have a large following on social media. But other than that, as you said, very loose. If you're from the West Coast, you may know them a little more. Many others became aware of Antifa in 2017. They showed up at the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally that gathered Nazis and white supremacists and then stopped the conservative Milo Yiannopoulos from speaking at UC Berkeley by smashing windows and lighting fires in Sproul Plaza there. So Berkeley decided to cancel the event. And this is why the right has long been positioning them as enemies of free speech.
Right. Well, they have a belief that denying fascists and people on the far right a platform is a way to stop their rise. And it's not just, you know, violence in the streets. It's also coordinated campaigns to shame, out, harass those on the far right. So the campaign against letting Milo Yiannopoulos speak was a successful one. They've also protested people like Ann Coulter, Michelle Malkin, and those sorts of people. And then smaller groups, you know, of people who were at the Charlottesville rally, people that are sort of Antifa aligned, have doxed those people, brought them out to their employers, just sort of made it very clear for all to see who the people were. In effect, it's, you know, taking de-hooding Klansmen is their theory, and that's part of what their actions are. And I would say probably that's what they mostly do. The street brawls that you're seeing in Portland are not their main activities.
No. But that is how they've been positioned by their critics. And with that in mind, rumors are flying that Antifa is showing up in small towns to wreak that kind of violent havoc, as Trump and Barr and some mayors and governors have claimed. So what has your reporting found?
Yeah, what we found is that it's been sort of a top-down disinformation campaign from the president and the president's allies, down to local law enforcement, and then through social media. And what's happened is that it's resulted in groups of armed militias really taking the streets to counter-protest small Black Lives Matter protests. We've seen this in Idaho. We've seen it in Florida. We've seen it in Oregon. In Oregon, had hundreds of counter-protesters armed, ready to fight this invisible monster of Antifa that they heard on social media was coming to their town to murder people, murder white people, take their guns, and destroy their town. Of course, Antifa never came, but what they did do was intimidate a large group of diverse people who came together to peacefully protest police brutality in their small town.
We, by the way, had a piece yesterday out of Missoula, Montana, where the same thing happened. Armed with guns, whites showed up to fend off these Antifa fighters that they had been told were coming. They never came. But I want to be clear. Are you saying that Antifa is not showing up at all? These are now peaceful protests for the last, you know, over a week. But in the beginning, when we saw the violence, are you saying that Antifa wasn't there?
No, I think that it only makes sense because inherently a large factor in Antifa ideology is anti-racism. So I would say there's a very good chance that people who, you know, call themselves Antifa would be at these protests. However, as you stated, the evidence suggests that there is no evidence to link any people who are with Antifa to any of the looting or property destruction. And that's, you know, based on the FBI internal report. It's based on the protest-related indictments reported by the Daily Beast. There's just no evidence to say that's the case. What the evidence points to is that the small bits of looting or property destruction has really more from local opportunists, you know, just regular old criminals that we've always had. It's not, you know, Antifa.
But what are you hearing might be the danger of armed whites showing off to fight off this invisible Antifa force that they say, you know, is coming to their town to be violent when in fact they're not coming? And what you have instead are peaceful protesters, as we've seen for days now. You know, is there a concern that at some point some of those peaceful protesters might get accused of being Antifa, as we saw in Buffalo with the elderly man that President Trump says was an Antifa member? And he wasn't. He was member of a longtime member of a peace organization.
Yeah, we've already seen around the country some examples of these sort of vigilante mob mentality taking over these small towns. In Forks, Washington, a multiracial family was camping using a refurbished bus, and locals egged on by a gun dealer on Facebook in their town, they went and they felled trees and cut them off so they couldn't escape the campground. They were terrified. They had to be rescued by some high school kids. You know, in McAllen, Texas, we saw a man armed with a chainsaw run off protesters. And in Klamath Falls, you know, there were several arrests of, you know, drunk people wielding AK-47s and ARs. It just seems like a powder keg. And people that I've spoken to, activists from small towns to larger groups on Black Lives Matter side, they're very concerned for their safety.
Well, and we should also say they have also spoken out against Antifa's tactics. Obviously, they're speaking out against sometimes white supremacists, but at least whites showing up with guns to fight Antifa. But they've also said to Antifa, in many cases, that the violent tactics are completely contrary to what they stand for. Brandi Zadrozny, investigative reporter at NBC News, will link you to the rest of her deep dive on Antifa at hereandnow.org. But Brandi, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Last week, we heard about how far-right extremist groups like the Boogaloo Movement and Oath Keepers and the Three Percenters are mobilizing online and then going to protests to sow their own brand of chaos. Alex Goldenberg with the Network Contagion Research Institute recently put out a report on what he calls the militia sphere. Here's what he told Tanya.
They're seeking to co-opt these recent protest movements to further their own objective, and the objective is to promote sedition and civil war.
The Institute says it's tracked these right-wing groups at least 40 George Floyd protests.
In Brazil, the number of people dying of COVID-19 is growing. There are nearly 40,000 reported deaths, second only to the United States. This health crisis is mobilizing the political opposition to President Jair Bolsonaro, who is hinting of a possible return to military rule in the country. For more, NPR South America correspondent Philip Reeves joins us now. Welcome back, Phil.
Thank you.
What is life like in Brazil at this stage of the pandemic? How are hospitals handling this crisis? And really, to what extent is the country locked down?
Well, medical experts say the virus hasn't yet peaked in Brazil, and yet towns and cities are opening up across the map. A quarter of the country's deaths were in Sao Paulo, yet there are really densely packed crowds in some shopping districts in the metropolitan area of Sao Paulo. Rio de Janeiro, the country's second largest city, is opening shopping centers today. Now, there are rules, masks and, you know, alcohol gel, restrictions on numbers and so on. But there have been 100,000, more than 100,000 infections in Brazil in 4 days. And doctors are really worried about this opening up of the economy at this point. It is true in some places, the numbers are tailing off. But those are the minority. And there's particular concern about Brazil's north and northeast. Four states there are critically short of intensive care beds, with occupancy rates above 90%.
You've reported that President Bolsonaro actually tried to keep coronavirus statistics off the health ministry's website.
Yes, indeed. And it didn't go down well. There was a major outcry in Brazil about it. Six media organizations, and I'm talking about the big guns in the Brazilian media, teamed up with health departments from the country's state governments to produce numbers of their own. Doctors and scientists condemned the move, saying, look, we can't possibly fight this virus if we don't have access to proper information. So the Supreme Court ordered that the government restore the data, and the government did. But it did cause a major outcry.
You've been reporting on political issues in Brazil for quite some time. Is there a coherent political opposition to Bolsonaro right now?
Well, it's very interesting. We're seeing new forces emerge online. These are pro-democracy grassroots movements from across a broad spectrum. They include artists, lawyers, actors, musicians, journalists, judges, people who consider Bolsonaro to be a threat to democracy and who are mobilizing in its defense. Remember, their country was under a dictatorship before the mid-1980s. That regime killed and tortured people. Bolsonaro speaks admiringly of those years. But a lot of Brazilians know that their democracy is fragile.
Is a military coup a possibility?
Well, there are certainly hardcore supporters of Bolsonaro who want that. They say they elected Bolsonaro in 2018. The judiciary and Congress are stopping him carrying out his policies because, in their minds, they're politically motivated, and that means they're subverting the democratic will of the people. So they want that. Certain comments by Bolsonaro and his inner circle have also set off alarms. Bolsonaro himself the other day was talking about ignoring a court order, and one of his sons, Eduardo, who's a congressman, recently said that he foresees what he called a rupture with democratic institutions. So there was a lot of worry about that. Talk to political analysts, though. Most of them say it's unlikely, but they don't rule it out. There's a general theory that this might be saber-rattling by Bolsonaro and his allies, a warning to governors, the courts and Congress, and also to prosecutors, a warning to them to not step too far over the line.
We've been reading about COVID hitting poor communities, the favelas, really hard. What measures are being taken to lessen the spread in those areas?
Well, in Rio's favelas, these are the shanty towns, grassroots community leaders have started to mobilize. They've set up internet platforms. They distribute food and information and equipment. They've set up crowdfunding campaigns. These are communities that realized that the government wasn't going to do nearly enough for them, or if anything at all. So they decided that in order to survive this pandemic, they had to take control themselves.
We've been hearing also people speaking out there, as you mentioned, and feeling alienation from the government, and also racism. It's a big national issue this week. Is this related in any way, this calling out to George Floyd and the anti-racism protests here in the United States?
Well, yes. I mean, these communities I'm talking about in the favelas, they're mostly black. And a lot of these people who are now acting as community leaders are young and black. And they're watching the mass protests in the U.S. very closely. The cops in Brazil killed 5,500 people last year, mostly black males. And in April, in Rio's favelas, they killed nearly six people a day. So this is an issue that arouses extremely strong sentiments, this issue of police brutality and racism in Brazil. And now those activists that are emerging as community leaders to tackle COVID-19 are using those new internet platforms to distribute information about police brutality. And a lot of people are listening to them because they have a lot of credibility right now because of the work they're doing to combat the virus.
That's NPR South America correspondent Philip Reeves, based in Rio de Janeiro. Philip, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.